This year, we've got to get by with one-third less water in our regular supplies than normal. There's two takeaways from this, and I'm just going to run through the study. As an economist, I was interested in what's the economic effect of this water, and as a resource and agricultural economist, I'm looking at the impacts on the agricultural sector, although we are tied in also with the urban sector. So what we did is we took a model, which is just a computerized version of what we think farmers and prices and quantities will do, and we linked it at the bottom end to an engineering model of ground underground water flows. And on the top end, we linked it to Landsat satellite projections. And we have the economic model operating in between them. And so we're going to look at this and project it out and say, what is likely to happen this year and next year? So first slide, please, and I'll just talk over them, and away we go. We click it up. Do I click it up? There we go. It bings at me anyhow. There we go. So these are the districts of our main economic model. And here's California. And for those of you who have been deficient in your education and not been there, you can tell by my accent, of course, that it's about 1,000 miles from top to bottom. You know, we run water 660 miles from where it occurs in the top, and Jay will show you later, to where the money is in the bottom. And this goes to, of course, the fundamental law of economic hydrology, that water flows up hills, over hills, towards money. And so that's why the economics of water is particularly important. And we have these models linked. We did a survey, and this first model is water-driven. And then when we come back with the satellite data, we're looking at land from a spectral remote sensing point of view. And we are interested in how much ability the farmers have to switch their supplies from these normal surface river and canal water to the underground water, which we call groundwater. And then we're going to run another year out using some projections from 2009 of what 2015 and 2016 might look like. So here's what we're losing. We're losing 6.5 million acre feet, a million acre foot. An acre foot is 330,000 gallons, so you can run your calculations in terms of gallons, and it's billions. Likewise, we're losing most of it from that central part of the valley, which is the key agricultural area. In terms of the ability to replace it, we've measured that ability to replace it, and we think that we'll lose 6.5 million, that's one-third, but 75% of that, we're estimating, will get replaced by the additional pumping of this underground water, which we normally have plentifully supplied, but remember, we're running down our bank account. And here's the impacts. Our net water shortage is only 1.6 million acre feet. We're losing about 810 million direct farm gate value. We are spending another $500 million on extra pumping. And our livestock sector, which is losing 200 million through increased prices of feeds. Overall, if we run this through the entire economic model selection, we lose about 2.2 billion worth of revenues. But what really hurts is we're also losing 17,000 jobs. These are seasonal, mostly seasonal jobs, but they're seasonal and full-time. And they are from a sector of the population who have the least ability to roll with the punches. And this is really important because whilst on average, you in Washington and elsewhere will all get your fruits, nuts, raisins, vegetables, and wine, but there are pockets of extreme deprivation where they're out of water and out of jobs. And so we have, on average, it's not so bad, but in certain parts of the Central Valley, it's extremely bad. And if you're one of the 17,000 people who lose their job, it's extremely bad. So I'm trying to get a balance on this economic picture between rolling with the punches, but still having pockets of pain and poverty. So what happens to the land reduction? And we've got three main areas. We've got north of Sacramento, divided by rivers, north of Sacramento, the San Joaquin, which is the northern part of the Central Valley, and then the Tulare Lake Basin, which is at the bottom. And then we have the coastal regions. It turns out the coastal regions, those of you who are wine aficionados, don't worry, your Napa wines will be just fine, as will the Monterey and the other ones. The vegetables are largely grown with underground water, and we think that the price of lettuce will not be going up. The broccoli will be there as usual. What we do see, though, is we see in the Tulare Lake region that green histogram is actually a loss of permanent crops. And when we switch from a land area, acres, to money, we see that the real costs are coming in with the loss of some of these permanent crops. And so there are some citrus orchards, some almond orchards, which are just going to be dried up. And this is a loss not only of revenue for this year, but for a future stream of years, because this is a permanent capital asset. And so whilst if we look at the areas, you'll see the blues and the light blues are the biggest areas. If we focus, as an economist, I'm interested in money, then you suddenly see that this relatively small area of permanent crops dominates the money effect. And that's where the multimillions come in. So again, this is a reiteration of what I had before. 17,000 jobs, $2.2 billion of revenue, and half a million or 430,000 acres additional land fallowed. Fallowing, of course, is when the farmers do not have the water to irrigate the land. And in California, no water, no crops. Here is an example of detailed land use from outer space, and we worked with our colleagues in NASA and the Department of Water Resources, and we used the Landsat satellite, they used the Landsat satellite, to identify, using a thing called Normalized Relative Vegetative Index, NDVI, a measurement of the degree of greenness at certain times. And these are shots built up from a flight the satellite took about 3.5 weeks ago. Because what we're trying to show here is how to manage drought, we need timely information. And this is one source of timely information. The other interesting thing is that you can see the proportion of idle land, and we can't directly say all of this was caused by water shortage, because there's other reasons of late season planting and so on. This might be exaggerated. But this is the same, is a good indicator. In terms of the cross-check of the economic model, two out of the three regions cross-check closely. This third southern region actually is got much higher values from satellite readings than the water-based readings. Those will reconcile as the season comes on. What I want to stress to you is that we have the ability to both interact with the engineering models to look at the number of wells that might go dry on one side of the economic model, and back up to the satellite information on the other. So, what further work do we have to do? We have to have more interaction with these underground water models, because it's quite clear that the underground groundwater is the reserve bank account. The problem is that California is almost uniquely in the western states of not measuring our groundwater. So we're like somebody who is so rich they don't have to balance their checkbook. We're walking around signing checks and not even balancing the checkbook, because we still think we are in a groundwater-rich era. And so every other western state has started to measure its groundwater, and we don't even measure our groundwater. I live on a small property. I have two wells. I pump what I want to pump. I pay the electricity bill. That's it. So we are operating with a Daniel Boone type economy, in terms of water. You remember Daniel, that he built a cabin, and then wood was cheap, but nails were expensive. So when he moved on, burn the cabin, pick up the nails. Don't worry about the person coming behind you. Well, it made sense for Daniel, and it made sense for California when we had lots of water. It doesn't make sense any longer. The other thing is we have to work with this remote sensing, because not only can we measure where the fields are fallow, but there are techniques which we're working with to measure the actual water use on the fields. And then finally, as the drought and afterwards goes along, we have to do a retrospective analysis. We also think that the water transfers between relatively water-rich areas and relatively water-short areas need to be encouraged and facilitated. And so these are the areas of additional work needed. And now I'm going to hand over to my colleague Jay Lund, who is going to give you some really interesting stuff on what will happen next year.
Thank you. One of the interesting things about droughts is you're not really sure when it's going to end. You know with a flood, it's going to end in a few hours or a few days. You know with an earthquake, it's going to end hopefully in a few seconds or a few minutes. But with a drought, you're never really sure when it's going to end. Is it going to be a 2-year drought? Is it going to be a 6-year drought? Is it going to be a 12-year drought? And in the history, paleo history of California, we have 200-year droughts, if you go back and look at tree rings and things like this. So is next year going to be dry? It's a good question. Are we going to go for broke this year and, empty all the reservoirs in the hope that next year is going to be dry? They talk about El Nino all the time. So will next year be dry? So let's look at the 106 years of record. We are in a critically dry year this year. Department of Water Resources classifies years into 5-year types, from critically dry, dry, all the way to wet. If you're in a critically dry year this year, then the chances that next year will be critically dry in the Sacramento Valley, which is where most of the water comes from, is 29%. The chances that it'll be merely dry is 35%. So there's a very good chance that next year will be dry or critically dry, given that this year is dry. It basically doubles the chance that next year will be a drought if you're in a deep drought this year. So that's the first point, I think, to make. It's a similar story for the San Joaquin. Now, you say, okay, but they talk about El Nino all the time. What does that mean? So here's a plot of the 50-some years of record where we have the annual runoff. This is for the Sacramento Valley. And the El Nino index. So further over to the right is a bigger El Nino. Further over to the left is a smaller La Nina, right? I'm from California. I should know these things. So you can all see the trend here. This is citizen science. Can you all see the trend there? Okay, so I tried to use some of the more advanced scientific techniques to try to tease out the trend here. And I also will add some additional data for the San Joaquin. There it is. So I fit all kinds of lines. I get maybe 1 or 2% explanation. One that has the most explanation, which is actually not a good fit, is that smiley thing at the top. I get 8%, but it's a use. Anyway, don't count on El Nino. It's not, probably not relevant. It's more relevant in the southern part of California, particularly for floods. It's less relevant for Northern California for droughts. So that's that. A little lesson in water in California, since we're in the east. The map on the left shows the precipitation in California. Notice how that really dark blue area is the 20% of the surface area that provides 2/3 of the runoff in California. That red area, also notice where the agricultural areas are. Down here in the Central Valley, down here, and along the coasts. The agriculture and the people are where the water ain't. And our water use is in the summer. And we have a Mediterranean climate in California. Beautiful summers, dry. So the water is where the water demand ain't, both in space and in time. And so in California, the map on the right shows the infrastructure, the huge amounts of infrastructure that we've built surface water, groundwater, dams, reservoirs, all kinds of things, all sorts of water agencies to move this water around. On the lower left, you'll see a pipeline with a little person in it. That's one of our smaller pieces of infrastructure to move water around. And so we have a very integrated system. When we had a drought in the 1860s, when we were primarily an agricultural economy, aside from the little bit of mining we did, it basically destroyed the whole economy because at that time it was rain-fed cattle grazing and basically destroyed the entire economy when we have a drought. It's remarkable to me that we have so little impact because we have this infrastructure and a lot of the management and water markets and groundwater that we mentioned before. So some lessons of the overall effort for policy. Droughts are inevitable in California. We have a dry state. We have earthquakes, and we have droughts. In the East Coast, you have thunderstorms. You have hurricanes. Nobody thinks, okay, we have to hurricane-proof the Outer Banks. I mean, nobody even thinks about that. It's not possible. Same kind of thing in California. You can be prepared for them. You can be prepared for these disasters, but they are inevitable. The approach we should take is a portfolio approach. There's a lot of different things. We have a lot of folks saying, we should do this, we should do that. We need to do a lot of little things, some big things, combined, integrated together in a thoughtful way. Groundwater is very high on that list. As Richard said, 75% of the water, surface water lost to due to the drought is being made up with groundwater pumping. Water markets are very important for reallocating that water in this very dynamic economy, dynamic climate that we have in California, so that we stay on top of things. And information is really important, that third flow that keeps California's economy going, potential for remote sensing estimates, and the importance of us going back after the drought and after the press is over to go back and do this retrospective. So that's where I'd like to end it. Thank you very much. Followed by Secretary Ross.
Great job. I have no PowerPoint, but I am pleased to take a few minutes to talk about why we requested this study and how it's being used, and why California agriculture is a unique gift to the citizens of this country and increasingly to citizens around the world. When we look at California as the number one agricultural state and has been since USDA started measuring our output over 60 years ago, and it's also the number one exporter of agricultural goods and products. A lot of that is because of the great, unique Mediterranean climate that we've been blessed with, the great soils that we have, the wonderful institutions like the University of California, and the really smart and resilient farmers and ranchers who are constantly diversifying the agricultural portfolio to respond to markets. And that certainly is one of the changes that's happened a lot in agriculture since the drought when I moved there in 1988. And that is moving higher and higher up to higher value crops that are permanent in nature. And that's probably one of the most significant changes in our agricultural landscape that we're very mindful of when we look forward to how do we better prepare, plan, and respond to droughts, which we know are inevitable. California agriculture has done a lot over the last 50 years to improve its productivity and to better use water more efficiently. In fact, we've had over an 80% gain in productivity using the water that we have much more wisely and much more precisely. Almost 50% of our irrigated acreage is actually under some sort of precision irrigation technology. That could be drip irrigation, micro sprinkler irrigation, or drip tape, which has really been a significant contributor to us being the producer of over 95% of the processed tomatoes. So if you like salsa, pasta sauce, and ketchup, California is your source, and we're happy about that. We are also a significant dairy state. Over 20% of the milk that's produced in this country comes from California. 400 different commodities. So we have a lot depending on water, which is what it takes to grow livestock and food and feed crops in California. We commissioned this study because in 2009, it was the first time in a drought that we tried to evaluate what the socioeconomic impact is of drought. It was very important because we were caught somewhat by surprise by food lines in Western Kern and Fresno and Tulare County. Those people that are so dependent on those seasonal jobs were at the same time without employment and going to food banks. So doing this report early this time so that we could better target the resources that the legislature and the governor made available was one of the major reasons we wanted to do this. But we also knew that droughts will happen again because of our changing climate. We're very focused under Governor Brown's leadership to really looking at mitigation and adaptation and how do we put resiliency into our systems at the local regional scale as well as on a statewide scale to be able to survive droughts better. So we believe that this is a very valuable tool for us moving forward. Before we knew how serious this drought was last fall, Governor Brown asked the Resources Agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, and my agency, the Department of Food and Agriculture, to create the California Water Action Plan. What he wanted was a comprehensive but focused list of actions that we could take over the next 5 years to better prepare our state for our water future. A water future that will grow from 38 million people to 50 million people by the year 2049. A water future that still has a fast-growing economy that is very dependent on water, whether you're doing computer chips or broccoli. And a water future that will be part of a changing climate. That water action plan actually addresses some of these water policy issues that you've highlighted, Jay. One is that there's no single action that we can take to better survive drought in the future. It does take a portfolio approach. It requires that Californians develop an ethic of conservation, that we improve our water use efficiency on our farms as well as on our urban landscapes, that we embrace recycling of water, that we're capturing stormwater, that we are investing in storage, whether it's above ground or below ground. And yes, it is time for more effective groundwater management. And that is a focus right now of extensive dialogue in our state capitol. We've had two bills introduced. Governor Brown released his framework for what he thought effective groundwater management would look like in California. We have groundwater basins in some parts of the state that are very well managed, but we have others that need additional tools and authorities, and that's what the Brown administration is committed to doing. We believe that groundwater is best managed locally, that we have too many geographic and hydrological differences, diverse economies and diverse stakeholders to try to make a one-size-fits-all. Local management with the authorities that they need is goal number one. We want a definition of sustainable groundwater management. We want to provide the tools and the technical expertise to assist the local authorities to better manage their groundwater. Those funds have already started to be made available through the budget this year with resources for the Department of Water Resources to be able to provide groundwater information to the extent that we have it, as well as best management practices and guidance on how to develop local groundwater plans. We also, as a state, have signaled that we will intervene on a very narrow, focused way when local authorities are unable to develop an entity to manage that groundwater or to have effective groundwater plans that meet the goals and objectives that are stated. So we are prepared for a very vigorous discussion our last month of the legislature, which will start in August. The governor signaled 3 weeks ago that he is supportive of a groundwater bond. A water bond. Groundwater would be a part of that. And so those negotiations will be something else that will be going on during the month of August. We think that this investment in restoration, the investment in storage, having effective groundwater management, recommitting to recycled water, stormwater capture, flood planning, and conservation will all help us be more resilient going forward. And with that, I think I've left just enough time for hopefully a lot of good Q&A. Thank you, Diane. I really appreciate this opportunity. And to the professors and the university, thank you for maintaining your sense of urgency. We have already put hundreds of thousands of food boxes out into the Central Valley. We've been able to target assistance for housing. And so you've really helped us put those resources that the legislature provided earlier this year to good use for our people. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Karen, Jay, and Richard. I'd now like to open the floor for questions. Does anyone have questions for our speakers? Mike.
Yeah, Mike Doe from Appalachian Newspapers. Could you speak to what role, if any, additional storage capacity would have in meeting the short to midterm water needs of the state?
I need to repeat the questions for those people who are following via the webcast. So if I understand you correctly, what role does storage play in meeting the state's needs?
Well, storage is very important for water management in California. You can see the tremendous amount of water that's coming.